Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, hello, hello. This is Lawrence McCarron, the New Books Network special series on military fiction. In this series, we're going to introduce you to some of the best authors writing military fiction today. Small unit tactics are super central to military fiction. Anybody who's read military fiction, is the next thing that's getting you turning those pages are those small unit tactics, SEAL teams hunting for the bad guys, and all that good stuff. So today we're focusing on that with our book Shadow Wars by Jake Kamansky. Jake, how you doing?
I'm doing great. How are you, Lawrence?
Doing good today. So getting into your background, I was as I'm turning this book, I just see some expertise coming through. Can you tell us a little bit about your background?
Yeah, I was an undercover cop, and then I ran undercover operations in South Florida during the, I guess, piece we always kind of affectionately refer to them as the Miami Vice years in the late 80s and 90s. I ran undercover ops against the Colombian cartels, worked undercover also, but mostly at that point, I was really running ops with my men and women that worked for me. After 25 years, I retired, and then I went to work for the United States government as an advisor, special advisor on undercover ops and covert ops to some of our allies around the world.
You say around the world, so where exactly did you spend your time?
Majority of my time was spent in the Balkans. I got there right after the war, the war between the old Yugoslavia, the former Yugoslavia. So we were there to assist, advising on things like, you know, the tracking down of war criminals, dealing with helping them build up a capacity to go after people that were trafficking in women. And things like organized crime and drug trafficking. And most of our time was spent not only there, but also in other countries in Eastern Europe.
Oh, wow. So when you're, were you out in the communities, seeing kind of the aftermath of some of that?
Yeah. When I was first there, we were attached to the NATO forces in a part of S4. And so we were out and about. We didn't stay on a military basis. We stayed out in the communities, whether we were in Zagreb or Bosnia and Sarajevo, or in, we also did some consulting in Kosovo and Montenegro, different places like that, all places that had been affected by the war, particularly early on in Bosnia. There was so much damage from all the ethnic cleansing and stuff like that. It was quite a shock to me, really.
I can only imagine. I mean, we were sitting stateside seeing some of the imagery on the news coming from that area. I know seeing that firsthand must have been pretty hard.
It was humbling to me to see what people had gone through, and yet they still kept their spirits up. It was a whole something I'd never thought of before. And later, you know, I would read a lot about it, and because, you know, when you're there, you just see it firsthand, but you don't see the big picture. But then later, reading about it and saying that it was the biggest genocide since World War II, which was really shocking to me. And I think the world was a little slow to realize how bad it was before the United States finally intervened. But my goodness, whole villages destroyed. And really, in a way, it was about a lot of things. It was about, you know, a lot of it was religious based also, though. So it was quite puzzling to see, you know, so many people killed in essence, a lot of it in the name of religion.
Especially your religion that teach peace. So as part of the person, you know, helping people with the criminal investigations, the war crimes investigations, do you feel like you were able to leave kind of a sense of closure in some with some people?
I think so. I mean, you know, we had huge teams of people. I was just one little person involved in all that. But I do think most of now, by now, almost all the Serbian war criminals have been, and I think a couple of Croatian war criminals were brought to justice. And yes, the big ones were taken to the International Tribunal in Hague and tried. And one of them, I think, passed away in custody. But the big architects of that, of the real massacres, are have all been caught.
That's good to know. Kind of fast forwarding, part one of your book has it placed in Central Bosnia, and I think it was 1994. How did the imagery that you evoked in the chapters there, was that inspired by your time there?
Yeah, absolutely. I think this was my first book. So I, of course, reached out to a lot of my colleagues that I served with. And I just wanted to say, does the atmosphere feel right? You know, because the atmosphere there was so dismal, even after the war, not because there was so much destruction, but also the climate there is quite depressing. Yeah. It's always gray and dismal there. And the air pollution is terrible from people not having any money, and you know they have coal burning plants there that it's just yellow smoke. And you know when you approach some cities there, it literally looks like something out of a science fiction novel. The air is so dirty. So I tried to evoke all that, and also the sorrow and sadness that came with trying to rebuild a country from nothing. And a lot of it came. I think a lot of those things came from my experiences there. And I wanted to find a link between the story I was going to tell on the Mexican border with another inhumane situation in Bosnia. So I think I was able to draw a good parallel. Maybe I always say a man's inhumanity to man. And I think it was there. And I introduced my main character, who's a Native American, a Lakota Sioux. He's a scout for a ranger company, and it's his first time really off the reservation. And I wanted to show the shock, because he had been living in sort of an insulated world of, you know, Lakota Sioux, and to come out in his first exposure to the Western culture of, you know, maybe white, we'd say white people, was seeing this confusing war among three different groups of white people fighting over God, basically fighting over God. And I wanted to show that confusion a little bit, and also show him as a young man, a brave guy, you know, scouting and just, you know, letting us get to see life through his eyes and his first awakening as a young soldier of 19 or 20 with really extraordinary tracking skills, because that's what he brings to the scene. And So it was a plot device to a degree to introduce him when he was a young man.
Right. When you introduce him, the imagery he's seeing is some of the most, awful imagery that you can kind of think of as in a ethnic cleansing environment. It's very thought provoking. What the picture you're painting.
Well, you know, when I first wrote the first drafts, a couple friends, my wife included, and a couple others, they said, "Jeff, you've talked to me about this, and it's darker than you wrote." And I said, "I know." And then I had a good friend who's a writer as well out in L.A. who does screenplays, and I'm not going to name him right now, but he was really helpful to me. And he says, "Jeff, just tell the truth. You know, just tell it like it is. The reader can't fool the reader. So just tell it as it is." So I did.
And it really comes through. There is the imagery of, and I don't want to give away the story here. But the imagery you provoke is just, it really brings you back to what is man capable of, in the most awful situations.
Yeah. I think we're always shocked with that. I think even now, I mean, we've seen so many movies and read so many books about, you know, the camps, concentration camps in Germany. And, you know, of course, it always seemed a little bit historical to me until I saw it when I was there. And I am, you really wonder, how can somebody be whipped up into such a state But obviously we're capable of it, I'm sorry to say. And, you know, like I say, it's only a few chapters that introduces the character, but I think it sets the stage for what we're seeing on a, you know, not as broad a scale on the Mexican border, but we are seeing with the cartels, who really also have very little or no value for human life.
Absolutely. So for before we kind of go into the major parts of the book for the part two, what actually overall brought you to wanting to write this book?
Well, while I was over in the Balkans, mostly my job was to organize training programs, and we had brought over some trackers, some military guys, and also some Native American trackers to help teach our allies there some techniques in tracking. And I got to know some of them. They were Navajo and I think a Pima tribe. And I at one point asked one of the military guys, I said, are you guys as good as they are? And he goes, no, we're not as good as they are. We don't even know how they can do all the things they could do because they're like magic. And I got to know several of them quite well over periods of months. And I was just so impressed not only with their story, the uniqueness of it, that they were able to do these things, the skills that were passed on for generations. I just decided that it would make a great book. I mean, I didn't want to write a nonfiction book because one, I'm not sure if my expertise could have handled it all. This is something that wasn't so well versed. So I thought, you know, there's gotta be a real human story in this. So I, for about three or four more years before I finally stopped, you know, doing my consulting overseas, I sort of was writing the book in my head, and I imagined characters based upon stories I'd heard from the different trackers and stuff. So I've always been kind of I always talk too much, you know, everybody always says I'm always jabbering and telling stories. And so someone said, maybe you ought to write a book. You tell so many stories. And so it was one of those things I've thought about for so many years, because I've been lucky enough to have quite an interesting life. And, never when I was doing my life, especially doing undercover ops in South America and stuff, did I ever think that I'd end up writing a book. But it turned out that it went okay. I mean, I have to give credit. If the book's any good, I have to give credit to my editor and several other people that have helped me along the way to make me actually sound smarter than I am. But anyway, it's been a great experience. And so I think it was really good to write these things down and give credit, because you know, I just think that people don't realize that we always say, well, we thank you for your service. But, you know, a lot of soldiers, I think that they do a lot more than just us saying thank you for your service. So I wanted to show what people that are doing for us, whether it's soldiers, whether it's trackers on our border, whether it's people fighting these fights against the real bad people. I thought, well, this story kind of helps to tell that tale.
And it's definitely coming through. So your time with the trackers, while you were overseas, it seems like it really imparted a kind of respect for Native American culture, because I kind of see it woven into the entire fabric of this book.
Yeah, it did. It did. It really did. And, you know, I have to say, one of the gentlemen that was with me a lot, I told him, I said, you're the guy I always wanted to grow up to be, you know, the guy could just do so much. And I sat in on some of the training sometimes, and then towards the end of these really serious trainings, they have practical exercises, and he let me partake in it. He said, you know, they have people go out and then they track them hours later. And he'd say, now, do you see that? And my God, I'd look at the same spot he was pointing at until my eyes popped out of my head and I couldn't see anything. You know, I just didn't have it. And I don't know how they can do it. It's just amazing. I know it's passed on from generation to generation, but it's quite extraordinary. And I just thought that their lives were definitely something for a book.
Some of the sequences you have in the book where, you know, it's the middle of the night and they're tracking some of the bad guys, and you're creating that environment where I can put myself in, kind of, you know, imagine just seeing this essentially a hunter stalking his prey. It's extremely vivid.
Yeah, I you know, it's funny. I have to, you know, so many people helped me with this book, and I had a colonel from a Green Beret colonel, some Rangers have helped, and, you know, just giving me little tidbits of how to, you know, what it feels like to be out in the field and doing these things. And then I added my work when I was working in drugs, especially in places like the Everglades and places when you'd be, you know, going after these real serious bad guys or meeting them in the jungles down in Central America. It was nice because I could draw upon those experiences. Of course, it's fiction, so you try to make them as interesting as you can. But I think it helped me a lot in writing it, just the mindset of knowing what it's like to do those things.
Now, something that's always striking for me when I'm reading military fiction, especially when you're talking about some of the state-on-state stuff, it's hard to write good bad guys. And I think, you know, you're writing about the cartel, it makes it so much more vivid when you can have the bad guys. They are some of the worst folks out there. And you really paint that well.
I think I did get to know them quite well. I mean, our operations against the cartels, and in those days we were up against the Cali and Medellin cartels, and you met really serious bad guys. I mean, you met them to negotiate drug deals, and you really realize that you are looking at, you know, cold-blooded sociopaths. I mean, they don't care. I mean, they used to have a saying in Miami, you know, when the Colombians were making a decision about if they doubted somebody, and they're one of them was famous. I can't remember which one of the cartel bosses is, when in doubt, just kill everybody. And that was pretty much the case. You know, we saw that so often. If we tried to, what we used to call flipping somebody, if we tried to arrest somebody and then get them to turn on their bosses, it was a very risky situation, because the Colombians, if they thought there was any chance that they were cooperating with us, they just kill them. And I tried to impart that. I mean, I'm dealing with, in the book, I deal with Mexican cartels, but, you know, in that job occupation, someone who's running these huge, powerful organizations, there's really no difference. I mean, there might be a little difference in the accent in between a Colombian and a Mexican, but other than that, the cartel bosses are what they are. They're ruthless, evil men.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
All right, and I think you have one of the cartel bosses in the book. He's almost trying to call back to I guess he's trying to get a sense of power from Aztec heritage and some of the gruesomeness that he's doing.
Well, you know, and my formal training in university was in foreign languages. And so I got to read a lot about the Mexican and the South American conquests, you know, by the Europeans. And there, I think it's a very unique situation in Mexico, because it's the Spanish, you know, conquest impacted their lives completely forever. And so many of their Native American cultures they weren't put on reservations. They were almost assimilated into it. And you almost had a different ethnic group, you know, a combination of Spanish and Native Americans. But there are a lot of parts in Mexico where in places like Chiapas and stuff, where they would like to get rid of the yoke of Western civilization and go back to their native roots. And so I sort of tapped into that with this main character, the main bad guy, in that he's saying he wants to go back to his Aztec roots and cast off everything from Christianity to the Spanish language to everything, and to speak in their native tongue. And yes, maybe it's not all genuine in my character's mind. I mean, because he's really using it to amass power, but he's also getting the people behind him, because there's so much resentment towards, you know, this Western civilization. So I'm trying to, I guess he's kind of an enigma, because we don't know if he's really means it or if he's using it as a ploy, but either way, it's working for him.
And I really go to make a more complex and believable character, at least from my perspective as a reader.
Yeah, I think it does. I mean, because we don't know exactly. He stays quite unreadable, even to his own people that work for him. I mean, he demands loyalty from his people, his underbosses, who are in their own right very powerful, except when they're in his company, then they're all petrified of him. But when they go back out to run their own crews, so to speak, as the American mafia used to call them, crews, but they're feared and everything else until they come to his stronghold in the Mexican Highlands, and then they're petrified of him. And I think he keeps I try to make this character to the point where, you know, he keeps his underlings petrified of him, because the only thing that really rules in that world is fear.
Well, and is that something that you gain from your time? As far as you observe the kind of power dynamic between the boss and the underlings?
Absolutely. Absolutely. They have ultimate power. I mean, and then really right now in Mexico, everybody's afraid of him. The government's afraid of him. I mean, I'm sure the president of Mexico is afraid of the cartels. And I think it's quite clear when we read the headlines. I mean, I think it was in 2018, the cartels in Mexico accounted for 33,000 murders. I mean, consider that. That's unbelievable.
Right. The amount of national mobilization that we would have in America, if that was a problem here, would be obscene.
Yeah, I think it would. I mean, it's a situation. And, you know, and I tried to make this book very non-political, because I recognize there's a political narrative about the border and the crossings and stuff. And I don't take an issue with this one way or the other. All I know for sure is, while we're fighting about it, the cartels are making money about it. And that's pure and simple. They don't care what our politics are, because they're still going to get drugs here, or people. Because that's the other thing that I try to talk about, and we talk about in the book a lot, is that, you know, several of the cartel bosses down there have made the comment, you know, I can sell drugs only once. I can sell women multiple times. And so they are really into trafficking women into the States.
That is something in the book that I see very well stated. The plight that women face in some of these dynamics. I mean, be it in central Bosnia or at the southern border, the beset of the cartels. It's just it's horrific.
Yeah, and it's I learned a great deal about it while I was in the Balkans in Europe, because it was really prevalent in Eastern Europe. Women had no money, and they were being lured into traps, and then their papers taken away, and then they were placed into sexual slavery, and they had no idea where they were even going to go. They were moved across borders by European organized crime bosses, you know, and there's a lot of really evil ones out there, the Albanians, the Russians, all of those people, and they were kept in slavery. And I got to learn a lot about how that worked. I, you know, got to talk to victims of it and started to realize the complete hopelessness of once you're trapped by this. And I think it came across in the book. I mean, everybody's told me it has. Now, again, sometimes parts of the book are a little not so much, maybe a lot of them, they're violent, but they're dark on parts of it. But it's just the truth. And so maybe I just wanted people to know what it's really like to feel helpless in these situations.
I mean, it's part of the messaging. It sounds like you're kind of sending a shot across the bow, but kind of a cautionary tale that, you know, these are the things that are going to continue to happen if we, we don't take these things seriously.
Yeah, I think they are. And I mean, I know the average person, you know, living in, you know, a nice small American town maybe doesn't think of these issues, but that doesn't make them not happen. They are there, they're happening. And, I think I try to paint the picture of that. And, you know, in the book, of course, I have my main character being the Lakota Sioux, but I also have two Apache women trackers who really become quite strong characters. In fact, they rival my main character as to be the main character. And I like to try to tell the story also through their eyes, because these are really strong women who can track bad guys across the desert. And their reaction to seeing these women enslaved and being dragged brutally across the desert, I think, kind of rings true as well.
I see it's a literary tool. You're kind of giving revenge to those women through those women, female characters.
In a way, yeah. I mean, and it's funny because my two Apache women trackers, they're very traditional, even more so than my Lakota main character. These women are proud, fierce, proud Apache women, and proud of their heritage, and rightfully so. They owned the desert. They owned the mountains of Arizona, you know, and they even use some of their language to talk about things. And in a way, they're very, even in the Native American culture, they view themselves as one of the more superior warriors of all the tribes. And I kind of let that come out because they're proud of themselves, and rightfully so.
That's something that as having a proud warrior heritage that of the Apache has always been extremely interesting to me as a reader.
Yeah, you know, and one of my characters is she's an older woman, but she kind of runs the whole Shadow Wolves outfit as an informal boss, as a Comanche. And when I'm in my research, I was just shocked when I'm not shocked. I was just overwhelmed with it when I read a nonfiction book about the Comanche. And the Comanche were maybe reputed to be the fiercest of all the Native American tribes. And it was an account about how the Spanish conquest, how they just pushed through Mexico and Latin America and, you know, killed so many people, millions and millions of Native Americans in Mexico. And then all of a sudden they came across to what is now Texas and what was referred to in there as the Comancheria, which was a huge section ruled by the Comanche. And it was the first time that the Spanish conquerors were no longer the conquerors. They were the prey. And they scooted right back down into Mexico after a short forays up into that area because they were so afraid of the Comanches. The Comanches were so fierce that they were the first people, Native American people, to turn back the Spanish conquerors.
I mean, you can only imagine how they felt, you know, at conquering these people after these people and then hitting that brick wall, you know, of a culture.
Yeah, it was really amazing. I was really happy to read it. But again, I learned a lot about the Native American tribe. I'm no expert on it, but I think I drew enough on it to at least tell a viable tale. And I'm going to continue to tell it in the sequel to the book.
Are you currently working on a sequel now?
Yeah, I'm probably halfway finished. I hope to have it finished by the end of summer, maybe sooner. But it's going to be called Ghost Walker, and it's going to continue the saga that starts in the first book.
You expect to have the same set of characters?
Yeah, I think, yeah, definitely. At least the ones that survived this book, yes.
So oh, no spoilers that. On that.
But yeah, I do think it's going to, I'm really happy with the second book, and it's actually coming off my fingers a little faster than the first one did, and I'm really anxious to finish it. I mean, at least the rough draft should be finished within about 2 months, and then the editors get it and make it look better.
Well, Jake, I think I've stolen enough of your time here. Before we go, is there anything that you wanted to say to potential readers out there?
No, I just hope if they get it, it's available on Amazon.com, BarnesandNoble.com, and some of the stores of Barnes & Noble as well. If they like it, just tell other people because I'm finding an audience. And, you know, we're just really now, it just got released worldwide. It's released in Italy and UK and a couple other countries that, you know, read English language stuff. It's available there also on Amazon. And I'm getting some pretty good reviews, which I'm happy. I mean, I didn't know how this was going to turn out. But I guess if anybody does read it and they like it, please tell your friends.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, again, thank you for your time. And I can't wait to read Ghost Walker.
Okay. Thank you, Lawrence.